This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peaceworks, presenting the second annual Gala Mardi Gras Benefit, Saturday, February 25th, 6 p.m. at the Grand Ballroom in downtown Salem, featuring music by Kate Sullivan and company, Voodoo Mountain Zydeco, and Zydeco Dance Lesson by Deborah Seek, plus the political satire of Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show, with New Orleans-style food included, auction with unusual items, and a no-host bar. Tickets at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.org.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland community-owned and operated public radio. It's Monday morning, February 20th, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is engineering. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. On this program, we regularly challenge and expose the malfeasance of governments and expose the ideology of our leaders as a class bias distortion of reality. We attempt to bring into focus the possibility of another reality, one grounded in the principles of equity and justice for all peoples. One quick comment on the past week's news. I always thought that it was a hard and fast rule of bird hunting that one never shot at a low-flying bird until it had risen above the horizon. On the other hand, if one has much blood on one's hands, how can one possibly claim that the worst day of one's life was simply in doing only that? Today in our program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Eben Goodstein, an economics professor at Lewis and Clark College and an expert in energy and climate change. They will be talking about peak oil and the inevitability of an energy crisis and appropriate responses. Jan Hocken and Denise Morris, two of our regular movie moles, will be discussing the film Cachet, a recent French import about a married couple being terrorized by videotapes being left on their front doorstep. Lori Bolden is here to discuss two interesting books that he has read of late, Penelope Lively's Jacaranda Oleander, A Childhood Perceived, and Ian McEwan's The Innocent, a novel. I'll be closing out the hour with a report on the exciting new tools genetists have developed for the study of human migration patterns from prehistory to the very present. Now here's Bill Resnick talking with Eben Goodstein, an economist at Lewis and Clark College.
Thanks, Tom. And Eben Goodstein, welcome to KABU.
Well, thank you, Bill. Nice to be here.
Let me talk about your last book, and then you can tell us about your latest one and just give us a title, and then we'll get into the interview. His last book is, Eben Goodstein teaches economics, The Dismal Science, but he's sort of the sunny face of The Dismal Science. His last book was Trade-Offs. Why did I write it down wrong?
The Trade-Off Myth.
The Trade-Off Myth, Fact and Fiction about Jobs and the Environment, and you're publishing another book called
A new book called coming out this summer. It's actually going to be web published, called "The Fighting for Love in the Century of Extinction: How Passion and Politics Can Change the Future."
Good, passion and politics is an excellent formula for a good life.
I agree. I think it's not only I joke when I give my talk about this that I'm going to talk about global warming and the meaning of life. And I really am talking about the meaning of life in a lot of different dimensions, because this morning we'll be talking about oil addiction, and of course the real problem that we're facing in the very short run with oil addiction is that we are filling up the skies with burned oil and causing the planet to warm.
Right. Eben, let's talk about climate change and why the addiction to oil and to intensive energy utilization of all kinds is so dangerous in so many ways, environmental, geopolitically, the kinds of military and political structures that get set up. Let's go through that and just remind people what it is, and then we can get into what your expertise is. I mean, what you've written so much about is the solutions and alternative technologies and why they would, in fact, be beneficial. But let's start with...
Well, we're coming on the heels of a previous show talking about peak oil, and so I think a lot of folks have been hearing about running out of oil, oil scarcity, and the reality is oil is a scarce resource, and sometime over the next 5 to 10 to 20 to 30 years, we are going to hit a situation where demand is going to be permanently in excess of supply, and that's going to mean rising prices. Some folks have a...
Really rapidly rising prices.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Yeah. I mean, some folks have a pretty apocalyptic view of the impact on oil prices. I mean, prices are definitely going to rise. To me, that sort of peak oil demand exceeding supply problem is one that is probably more manageable than the bigger issue of global warming and climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Because oil prices will rise. They may. What happens to oil prices is that when you get into some sort of when you have a tight supply situation, if you have some sort of minor event in Russia or the Middle East, then you get a spike in prices. So prices will gradually kind of spike up, come back down on a rising trend. That's the future that we're looking at, yeah, in terms of oil prices.
Although, of course, one reason that they aren't going to spike up enormously is because coal then becomes much, much, much cheaper, and they're going to use a whole lot more of it. But of course, that then creates even worse climate change, worse CO2 emissions.
Yeah, and I think that the real danger with the peak oil situation is that it will create a crisis environment in the energy field, and if indeed we are forced into a rush to coal or nuclear, which is also out there as an option, creates very large environmental problems. So I think that the whole peak oil thing, the resource scarcity issue, is going to be a challenge for our economy. I think the scarier phenomena that people are talking about is the potential for resource conflict. I would say low-level geopolitical conflict, wars, in the sort of mid-range to maybe 10, 20, 30 years out.
Yeah, they're sure to occur at some level. They are already right now.
That's right.
In a variety of countries.
Well, Iraq, for example.
Right. It also, though, isn't just the wars. It's the prevention of wars by creating authoritarian states.
Yeah.
Which... It seems to me that's also a very ugly phenomenon. It's going to happen. Every oil-producing country is going to become semi-dependent on some powerful military state, either China or the U.S.
I think that's true.
And they're going to create elites that run things in the most authoritarian way to pump that oil out. Nigeria, I mean, it seems to me that model, and that's a very dangerous model in a lot of ways because it's going to generate all kinds of civil war and vast amount of death in those countries.
Well, I mean, there's a thing in economics that's called a phenomenon called the resource curse.
Yeah.
And in general, countries that are dependent on a single resource do not have democratic rulers because there's so much wealth at stake. People scramble to control those resources they have historically.
Yeah,
and what we're doing is just really feeding those autocratic regimes and propping them up with these high oil prices.
Right, and the wealth is also so easily convertible into building a big military to protect yourself.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's becomes thuggery. It's just a recipe for thuggery, it seems to me, on an international scale.
Yeah, so that's what our oil addiction is doing outside of our country. But if we think about the real pressing issue right now, it's global warming. There's just no doubt about it. Jim Hansen this week in The Independent was quoted as saying, look, we have 10 years to stabilize emissions of global warming pollution if we want to avoid truly catastrophic outcomes. Jim is very concerned about the collapse of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets. If those two ice sheets were to go, it would raise sea level by about 50 feet, which would bring the Pacific shoreline of the Pacific Ocean up to about 14th Avenue in downtown Portland.
Well, you just told me you don't like to go through all these apocalyptic scenarios, I guess.
Well, this one is very pressing. It's one that is not really about economics. It's really about the physics of the planet. And there's a lot of ice out there that historically has melted and refrozen and melted and refrozen. During the peak of the last ice age, it was about 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is today, and sea level was about 20 feet higher. So we know that these outcomes are very possible, and we know we're pretty much locked into a 2 degree Fahrenheit warming. Jim Hansen is saying we got to hold it at that, and we have really a very short window of time to make sure that that happens.
You've written about, this is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for The Old Mole, talking to Eben Goodstein, who's written The Trade-Off Myth, Fact and Fiction About Jobs and the Environment. In that book, you talk a lot about new technologies and implementing new technologies and how doing that would not only be good for the environment, but in fact would create a much healthier economy with decent jobs. Tell us, what, if you were the czar right now, if you had George Bush's ear, and he went through another great transformation of himself and reinvented himself as a true Christian, or whatever. I take that back as a...
person of faith.
Somehow. A decent one. What would you suggest?
Well, I think...
And you want to meet the magnitude of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can look back to the oil crisis of the 70s and the actions that the U.S. Congress and took back then, Jimmy Carter's generation, actually. And as you recall, you know, we were facing a quadrupling of oil prices, and U.S. government began to subsidize clean energy, in particular wind power. In 1978, there was no such thing as a commercial wind power industry, but with some subsidies directed the industry, California doubled those subsidies. Wind power grew rapidly, and production prices fell from about 25 cents a kilowatt hour down to, you know, 3 and 4 cents a kilowatt hour now. So that was a tremendous act of foresight on the part of my father's generation, really. And that's what we need to do for future generations. And so if I was in charge, I'd be spending about $15 to $20 billion a year on clean energy research. Not a lot of money, really.
No, it's not. In fact, comparison to, what is it, a $500 billion military budget?
No, yeah, I mean, it's really a trivial amount of money, but that's what it would take to drive the clean technologies that we need. At the same time, I would institute a phased-in carbon cap-and-trade or pollution tax system, if you will, to gradually raise the price of coal and oil, and you wouldn't want to do it too rapidly because you wouldn't want to disrupt people's livelihoods and lifestyles. But if folks know it's coming, it's a kind of easy thing to adjust to. So get the prices right, develop the clean energy technologies, and I think that what's exciting about the suite of technologies that we're talking about here, biofuels, solar, photovoltaics, wind energy. These are distributed technologies that really get away from a centralized energy production system and really have the potential to liberate folks from not only from addiction to oil, Middle Eastern oil, but also addiction to mountaintop removal in the eastern states, the United States, massive strip mines, and the centralized energy production system that is really an artifact of the 18th century.
You know, there are those who argue, though, that none of these new technologies would create the concentrated energy that's necessary to drive an 18-wheel truck up and down the highways and the vast amount of energy use we now, in agriculture, for example. What, do we put 100 calories in to make 2 calories of food? I mean, 100 calories of heat to produce 2 calories of food. It seems to me those systems really are transporting stuff from around the world and instead of sort of locally grown. As well as just agricultural systems, even locally, have to be sort of weaned from this high energy use. Or do you think there's just an infinite amount of, the amounts of energy that could be created by these, by solar and photovoltaic and all the rest of them would somehow permit this kind of life? And also automobiles, which use a lot of energy, right? I mean,
sure. You know, I can't tell you what the future is going to be in 20 or 30 or 50 years in terms of the technology options that we're going to have on the table. But I think there's sometimes a false dichotomy that's set up between sort of reducing consumption and altering technologies? I mean, they're really quite similar. The only way you can reduce consumption is to alter your technologies. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, we need to feed people. And so we need food systems that get food on the table. And it's hard to say what the mix of kind of reduced oil use, increased electricity from photovoltaics, more biofuels, how are we going to do all this?
More public transportation, very high fuel efficiency for automobiles. Yeah. I mean, all those things would be part of the mix. Conservation of heat in homes.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I think that's the future that we're looking at, is just maybe not, certainly using less energy, lots less fossil fuels, that's a must, and using it a lot smarter, a lot more creatively, a lot more effectively, a lot more efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And you think the kind of investments that would be needed are, in fact, when you compare it to the U.S. military budget or all sorts of other waste, is...
it's trivial.
It's not... I mean, it's doable, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, in terms of
absolutely.
Just getting resources into researchers and developers and technologists' hands.
Yeah, I mean, we spent... I want to track down the exact figures, but I know it was less than $3 billion in subsidies in the early late 70s and early 80s to develop wind power. Tremendous leverage that's available here. And... Mm-hmm. The exciting thing about it is that once those technologies are ripe, then they spread automatically. So, you know, sometimes I know my students get discouraged a lot thinking about global warming. But I tell them that, you know, when I was their age, I used to lie awake thinking about all-out thermonuclear war that would destroy the planet in about 30 seconds. And
could still happen. I think you might want to keep worrying.
No, you know, I really stopped worrying about that.
You stopped worrying. Good.
So I mean, and, you know, now I think we need to worry about nuclear terrorism, obviously. So we might lose a city or two. But that's a lot different than the entire planet going up in, you know. So my point is that I tell my students is that when things look very bleak from one side, if you told me in 1983 that, you know, the world would be a very different place in terms of the nuclear arms race in 1992, I would have said, you're crazy. But it was. And so I think that that... with if we build the kind of grassroots movement that we need to make this energy transformation, the possibilities are very exciting for the future.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Evan Goodstein, who wrote The Trade-Off Myth, Fact and Fiction About Jobs and the Environment. Evan Goodstein, you've been arguing that it really would be possible that the developing technologies could, in fact, put off global warming and create a sort of a future of relative abundance for people. It seems to me the question, though, is that a sort of under authoritarian management and means, which it seems to me is quite possible, and the big companies buying everything up and just sort of running things the way they are now, slightly different for their profit. Or could we imagine a future where these new technologies, where the transformation of all of our productive systems are done in a democratic way to create much more democratic communities and better work, and we have a minute and 20 seconds to do that in?
Well, I would say yes, yes. In that case. I mean, I think that what is exciting about energy technologies in particular is that they do tend to break up the sort of 19th century centralized production process. The suite of technologies we're talking about now are very potentially liberating, but of course it's not all about technology. It's also about politics and people's desires for that kind of control over their lives.
You know something? I was wrong. We have till 9:23.
9:20. Okay, great.
Yeah, I was thinking we had only... Right. I'm not giving you those 3 minutes back. We have 3 minutes here. You know, we can go into that a little bit more, actually, mm-hmm. the way of ensuring a democratic, new technologies that are integrated into social life in a democratic way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the companies are going to, they're buying up solar, for example, and wind power, right, a lot of the big firms. It's, mm-hmm. in fact, now investment is really sort of pouring in, actually.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
My understanding is that Wall Street has decided this is something they can make a lot of money on. How do we, in fact, make it a kind of people's transformation rather than a company's transformation?
Well, I think that, you know, Ross Gelsman, who wrote a wonderful book called Boiling Point about global warming, sees in sort of the movement to stop global warming, to stabilize the climate, a new vision of limits, really, that are set at a global scale around around corporate-led globalization. And, I agree with him. I think that what is really exciting about the idea of people coming together to and looking out 50 or 80 or 100 years to say, this is not the kind of world we want to leave for our grandchildren, if we can do that in the arena of an energy transformation, then I think you're going to begin to put in place a mindset, really, and perhaps a set of political structures that will lead to a revitalized sense of control over mm-hmm. economic forces and a sense of that you can actually put some limits on globalization, and in particular have some social direction for the ways that your energy economy is going to develop.
You know, a lot of people argue, along with David Suzuki, or some people at least that I read do argue that, I love his line actually, exponential growth, i.e. capitalism, exponential growth is the creed of the cancer cell. That mm-hmm. is sort of capitalist development having to always create more and more profit on more and more fixed capital means ultimately the extinction of the planet as they just take everything into creating. Is there any way of, you've been talking as if sort of, at least up to now, that in fact we can maintain sort of a capitalist economy with constant profit on a larger base, and have a livable world. Are we going to have to? It seems to me that has to be changed. Ultimately, the people who want to profit more and more and more are going to have to give up that system that has, at least, bought them third, fourth, and fifth homes all over the world and vast bank accounts. I mean, can it continue that way?
Well, I would say here that I'm more focused on the short run at this point. I mean, I think we have about 10 years to stabilize global emissions of greenhouse gases, global warming pollution. What will happen in the future? That's a big question. But I think we need to focus on the political realities that we face today, because we ice sheets don't wait around for revolutions. They collapse when the planet warms a few degrees.
Of course, the question is whether the people who rent things will permit things to change without huge popular movements.
Huge popular movement is what we need, absolutely.
Right. Evan Goodstein, we look forward to your book coming up on your web book. Give us the title again, and when should we look for it?
Fighting for Love in the Century of Extinction, How Passion and Politics Can Change the Future. It'll be online in the summer of 2006.
Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. With us now is Larry Bolden. He's going to share some thoughts on a couple of books that have recently grabbed his attention. Penelope Lively's Jacaranda Oleander, A Childhood Perceived, and Ian McEwan's The Innocent, a novel. Larry?
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about two authors and two books. What they have in common is that they are both British, both brilliant, both writing about events during and slightly after World War II, and perhaps the most relevant commonality, both having written books that I happen to read lately in close succession. The two authors are Penelope Lively and Ian McEwan. Lively's book is a memoir entitled Oleander Jacaranda, A Childhood Perceived, and McEwan's an early novel of his, The Innocent. I consider these two writers to be literary giants of the past 50 years. Both write about lived time in ways that I find profound and extraordinary. It may be that only those of you who already have a passion for Lively will really enjoy her autobiographical account of the first 12 years of her life growing up in Cairo. It is not what you would call a page-turner, no twists of plot nor adventure, simply an adult woman trying to put together a few crystalline images from her past. I'm a reader who has a deep fascination for Lively's writings, and I read this little book wanting to know just how she could have become such an incredible writer with such a deep understanding of how we humans live in the past, present, and future all at once. Lively, like Immanuel Kant and many thinkers since, realizes that memory is a synthetic faculty rather than a strictly reproductive one. She understands that the mind is not so much a recorder and camera as it is a storyteller, a fabricator. And when telling stories about childhood, a storyteller that has to spin her tale from disparate shards of evidence. In her words, quote, "I've tried to recover something of the anarchic vision of childhood, insofar as any of us can do such a thing, and use this as the vehicle for a reflection on the way in which children perceive. I believe that the experience of childhood is irretrievable. All that remains for any of us is a headful of brilliant frozen moments already dangerously distorted by the wisdoms of maturity." Close quote. Lively was born in 1933, and her narrative covers only her first 12 years growing up in Egypt, plus a handful of memories from 1945 when she returns to England. For someone as ignorant of history and geography as I, Lively's account of Cairo, Alexandria, and the multifarious life forms of the Nile is both informative and mind-boggling. She recalls for us a land populated by a rich juxtaposition of Greeks, French, Italians, British, Maltese, Lebanese, Syrian, and Turks, and all seen through the eyes of a child, though informed by the acute mind of an adult looking back. But while Lively does want to tell her readers something about how the war impacted Cairo and the desert surrounding it, as well as a good bit about the long history of conquest and occupation by so many different powers, her primary concern is to talk about how children perceive and how the purity of childhood perception is lost to us as adults. Again, in her words, "No thought at all here, just observation, the young child's ability to focus entirely on the moment, to direct attention upon the here and now without the intrusion of reflection or of anticipation. It is also the Wordsworthian vision of the physical world, the splendor in the grass, and especially Virginia Woolf's creation of the child's eye view, a way of seeing that is almost lost in adult life. You can stare, you can observe, but within the head there is now the unstoppable, obscuring, onward rush of things. It is no longer possible simply to see without the accompanying internal din of meditation." Close quote. Just as in her masterpiece Moon Tiger, when Lively describes so wonderfully and tantalizingly the life of an old woman near death in a care facility, her mind alive finally only to the past, the present irrelevant, in this kaleidoscopic memoir we experience life through the eyes of a child captured, as it were, under glass. Her ability to deal with lived life simply stuns me. Ian McEwan also takes us to the past, but in this intricate little novel, we see the divided Berlin of the 50s as seen through the eyes of a young British man caught up in a joint project of England and America to spy on their Russian counterparts. McEwan uses a historical fact for the kernel of his storyline, an audacious and brazen attempt to tunnel under Berlin into the Russian-controlled eastern sector for the purposes of tapping Russian phone lines. And while the spy story and its convoluted subplots occupy a good bit of the novel, I see it much more as a love story between the innocent Brit and a slightly older and much less innocent German woman. There's no doubt that the novel is at least partly about the arrogance of the American forces in Berlin and the duplicity of their dealings, even with their supposed British allies. But it is also the story of a young man coming of age rather late in life and trying to learn how to love and trust. McEwan is quite obviously interested in the very concept of innocence and its close neighbor, ignorance. His hero, Leonard Marnham, is an innocent in so many ways. An employee of the post office, he suddenly finds himself in Berlin, using his knowledge of tape recorders and telephones to help Americans spy on Russians. And he's a virgin not only to spying, but also to sex. Not so surprising, perhaps, for a 25-year-old man in 1955, but he is profoundly naive as well as being a virgin. The German woman whom he meets and falls in love with is only slightly older, at 30, but she's already been married and has already learned a lot about the brutality of many men. And although Leonard is instantly alarmed and ashamed when he inadvertently admits his condition to Marie, she's heartened by it. Here is a man who can be taught, who will not assume that he already knows all there is to know about women and sex, and who might turn out to be gentle as well as worthy of trust. And so for quite some time, this book appears simply to be a sweet and rather lovely love story with a reader pulling for this couple to maintain and nurture their love. Of course, McEwen never lets the reader off easily. There are twists and turns to this plot that I would never give away, even if I had the time to do so. Instead, I will simply remind readers unused to McEwen that he can and does often write about events that are alarming, even gruesome. Let me say simply that this is not a Hollywood love story, so readers should beware. What continues to intrigue me about McEwen is his incredible ability to describe in great detail a moment or a day in a life, and to catch the reader up in the detail. One always knows when reading him that he's done his homework, and that his meticulous descriptions are lucid and informed. I recommend both of these books to you, and more importantly, both of these authors. They create feasts for their readers, and I'm so happy to be sitting at their tables. I've been talking about Penelope Lively's Oleander Jacaranda and Ian McEwen's The Innocent. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry, for that insightful critique of the two books. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Now in our studio are movie moles Jan Hawken and Denise Morris. Today they are turning their critical eye on the film Cachet, a currently running French import.
A videotape arrives at the home of George and Anne, a married couple with a young son, 12 years old. The image is a close shot of their apartment on a quiet Paris street and depicts the couple's mundane comings and goings day and night. George and Anne's comfortable and sophisticated existence is destabilized by the delivery of what becomes a series of videotapes. It's not the content of the tapes that initially disturbs, but the fact that they are under constant surveillance. The question is, how, why, and by whom? I'm talking about the film Cachet, directed by Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke, and starring Daniel O'Toole, Juliette Binoche, and Maurice Benichou. Hopefully I've done well with my pronunciations. I am talking carefully without a lot of detail because this is a film that really is best if the viewer knows very little about the details of the film's action and unfolding. But even still, director Haneke offers much more than plot and action. He offers viewers the opportunity to examine how we see things and how most of what we see has been mediated before it ever reaches us. He has this to say, quote, "My films are intended as a polemical statement against the American barrel-down cinema and its disempowerment of the spectator. They are an appeal for a cinema of insistent questions instead of false answers, for clarifying distance in place of violating closeness, for provocation and dialogue instead of consumption and consensus. How filmmakers understand their own films is one point of view. I am, of course, here with Jan Hawken. I'm Denise Morris with the Movie Moles. Jan, your psychoanalytic background will come in very handy in talking about this film, because there is a lot here about looking, about what you're looking about at, what when you're looking at it, under what circumstances you're looking at it, and who's doing the looking. So I'll let you roll with that.
We'll skip over the Oedipal drama in the family. That is one theme for now, and move on to some of the other themes in this film that could be taken up from a psychoanalytic film theory point of view that goes beyond understanding the conflicts of child and the family, and really takes up the question of how our anxieties and defenses operate in the realm of the visual, how films kind of capture and draw us in to states of paranoia, the experience of voyeurism. This cachet really draws on some of the conventions of film that have been kind of played with and critiqued in critical cinema traditions, that make you aware that you're looking at the film, that something's being constructed, as you were saying, that the images are being, that there's an eye behind the camera, and what is that eye doing? What's motivating the action? And here, unlike a lot of Hollywood films that, or studio films that draw you into a very voyeuristic position, and with action films, or the way in which even suffering and war gives you a kind of, gives you pleasure or satisfaction, even at the end where it's resolved and you feel some safety as you leave the theater. Here, even though we're drawn into the voyeurism of the camera and to understand that there's someone watching someone else, and that's part of the pleasure of the thriller, is you get to enjoy the person hiding who's concealed, who can watch other people in their comings and goings. Here, there's very little pleasure delivered by the voyeurism. I mean, the camera, this person who's watching them observes very mundane things. In fact, the lives of this bourgeois Parisian couple becomes increasingly empty and arid. It's as though the only exciting thing going on in their world is unraveling this mystery of who's watching them. And that in some ways it suggests the life and vitality of the society is outside of this bourgeois world, with its carefully appointed furniture just messy enough to appear that real people live there, but otherwise quite ordered and empty.
Yeah, it's true. And it's interesting. This film makes me think of films like Fatal Attraction, and I think it's Unlawful Entry, the cop who becomes a stalker.
Cape Fear, there are a whole lot of them.
Cape Fear, yeah,
middle class.
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. There,
yeah.
But and these are, you know, these American films are this, as the director describes, this barrel down kind of I'm action and just, you know, bombardment.
Yeah, where some middle class sanctuary is invaded by threatening, menacing forces
yes.
in society.
And the menace is monstrous and constantly coming back with new weaponry to torture the family, and there's the, you know, gearing up
in.
And it does seem like it is the most exciting thing that's ever happened to the family is to be menaced. And so what is interesting about this film is that while the plot line may not be so unique, and even the use of the videotape surveillance, lots of reviewers have looked at Lost Highway as another film that uses that kind of same idea. But this film has a real uniqueness about it. It's a real film goer's film, it does have a lot to offer.
And it's unusual to see a film that works both at the level of personal drama, because you become involved in kind of the breaking up of this illusion of a perfect life, which is not an uncommon theme, but how the drama doesn't just all stitch together neatly. So we find that the kids' preoccupations are quite different than the parents, as it turns out, even though they've kind of woven him into their preoccupations. That for kids it can be other other concerns altogether. And that and yet at the same time, it's, I think, most powerful as a political allegory, as an allegory about repressed memory of political violence in French history, that the film really relates to contemporary violence of imperial powers, such as the U.S. Occupation of Iraq, which is on the TV screen throughout the film.
Yeah, during a particular period where they're kind of deep into this period of time where they're being watched, the TV is on and it's a news report of the occupation of Iraq. And it is interesting because in some ways those images become almost an intrusion there. But I found them to almost be mocking this middle class family, this very, you know, intellectual and highbrow folks, as they struggle. Of course, there's nothing, you know, nothing funny about being stalked or watched by someone, but these images of war counterposed with the images of them struggling with this kind of dilemma about their menace. I mean, it's very wise to put those images together, and I think part of what's great about this film is you can read things in I think many different ways. So I read it both as kind of a mocking image, but also as something as a kind of cautionary, you know, this is the menace. The world's on fire, and we are sort of struggling day to day with trying to, you know, work out the dilemmas that come at us, big or small.
One of the potential criticisms of the film, although I haven't, it's not one I've seen in the reviews I've read so far, but there is a potential critique that the kind of breaking through of the memory of the, called La Nuit Noire, the night of 1961, where the police in Paris killed hundreds, estimates vary, but up to hundreds of Algerian peaceful protesters in the streets of Paris as they had been demonstrating against the French government, which was negotiating with the FLN, one of the resistance groups in Algeria, and that this was really a dominating, you know, it was their Vietnam and the precursor to Vietnam in many respects. But the way in which the Algerians' struggle for independence dominated French politics, the ways in which the FLN and the Algerian resistance fighters were cast as the terrorists, even in France, and yet who is the real terrorist? This was the center of this film, too. In the memory of childhood, it was a violent image that kept coming to the lead protagonist of this film, and yet wasn't clear who was terrorizing who. As it turns out, the French white man was terrorizing this young man in a certain sense. But yet, it doesn't really open up that period. And I suppose that is too much to expect. Perhaps, I mean, it wasn't a documentary on the Algerian War of Independence. But it seemed like at the end of the film, as people left the theater, what people were obsessing on in a kind of narrow way was interpreting the last scene and who, you know, which was very ambiguous. What was happening there? What was happening there? Which could kind of close off the wider historical specter of what was represented here.
Well, yeah, there's this way that the device the film uses of the videotapes, one reviewer actually questions whether or not the videotapes are actually George's own repressed memory, or, you know, or that they become at least, you know, some metaphor for that. That what he's dealing with is there's an incident that he has repressed, and in fact we find out that he has kind of forgotten about this boy in his life that he had done something wrong to and had forgotten. Obviously, the boy had not forgotten. And he is really unwilling and unable.
Was an Arab-Algerian man.
Yeah.
Living.
Yeah.
So there was the conflict was between European French white French and the Arab Algerians living in France.
Right, and he grew up on this estate. His parents employed this boy's parents. So the issue of him not just forgetting the memory, but forgetting the boy entirely is very interesting. And I think something else, other than how we interpret these images and these mediated images and the unconscious and subconscious and all of those great fun things, that is just this question of, you know, George holding himself accountable for this act, being very shameful and having an enormous amount of guilt about his behavior. But how do you hold a six-year-old accountable for actions that take place in the context of a long history of colonial activity, his role as a colonizer, the boy's role as the colonized, and yet his actions really were very sophisticated. He seemed to have a real knowledge of how those roles work out, how that class differential.
And what he was entitled to act out against this son of mm-hmm. Algerian immigrants.
And it says something about where it begins and how early this kind of stuff begins, how early we begin to internalize the kinds of roles and hierarchies and, as you say, what we are owed and what others are owed or not owed is a real important point in the film, and I think it raises. I mean, it's very complicated. A lot of the interactions, which there are few, between the white French and the Algerian French, are ambiguous. While racial tensions may be played out, the incidents themselves that trigger them are not entirely clearly about race. So it has this real nice way of creating polemics out of kind of incidents, which I think is good. I think that helps us along in some ways to understand how the smallest interactions in our lives have ramifications and broader consequences.
It's part of the title of the film, Cachet, suggests that there is a lot hidden from, of course, hidden from ourselves, the notion of the unconscious, but also repressed from our collective or shared history as well. And here, I think I was divided in how I understood this recovery in the film of a scene, a memory from childhood that seemed to be so kind of dramatic in its cruelty and then drove everything subsequently. You might say that this one traumatic memory drew on kind of conventions in popular culture in general, where there's one horrible thing buried away in the unconscious that continues to have this half-life that decays and destroys the soul. And I tend to not endorse those points of view, because how even a particular traumatic experience is incorporate into a life over time depends on subsequent events and much else that happens. Rarely is there one event in life that sets in motion a whole life. And here you could interpret it, the film is loading up too much on that one scene. On the other hand, it was, I think, a device, you could read it as saying something much broader, that this was an instance of cruelty that was possible and continue to have effects of which it was sort of a metaphor for something much broader, and that each generation kind of children play this stuff out along class lines.
Yeah, that I think that it does offer a lot in terms of this generation to generation and how we often cannot understand how it is that a group of people cannot pull themselves out. And, you know, European or white Americans have such a difficulty in terms of class and race understanding how these tragedies are perpetuated over time. And this film offers us maybe an insight into that, the damaging of the soul.
Although the representation of the police, the way the police were portrayed, I thought downplayed the role of the police in terrorizing the Algerian community. This night that was represented in the film, October 17, 1961, had followed a reign of of tyranny on the part of the police. I mean, they had been under attack by the Algerian independence movement and activists, but at the same time, the police had engaged in their own reign of terror. And in this film, the police were quite benign and really were more kind of innocent bystanders to the main action.
Yeah, that's certainly a point that could be brought up a little more deeply. Well, this is Denise Morris with Jan Hawken. We've been talking about Caché, a film we recommend highly. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Jan and Denise. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. The advancement in the study of human DNA and the genetic code has become one of the most controversial scientific topics since Darwin established the fact of human evolution a century and a half ago. Sociobiologists and social constructionists are at war regarding exactly how and to what extent human attributes and activities are hardwired in the genes versus what remains malleable to social and cultural influence. The political ramifications of this ongoing argument are enormous. For example, are humans inherently aggressive and future wars inevitable? Or are we by nature social beings, corrupted by the institutions that evolved during less enlightened periods of our history, with capitalism being the most recent and voracious manifestation? Institutions that can now be overcome through collective will and effort. Is the formation of hierarchical social structures innate to human organization, or again, a product of our past that can be overcome by determined human agency? For the left, this hoary battle raises the very question of whether a more humane and just world is a utopian dream or an at least partially realizable hope. However, there is one area of genetic study that is not controversial, well, except to religious deniers of the very fact of evolution, and that is a study of human migration patterns that are encoded in our DNA and genes. I became interested in this subject when, at a recent lecture at Portland State University, I learned that archaeologists and anthropologists have virtually ceased all studies related to the subject of human migrations, as evidenced in the distribution of human artifacts and bones, discoveries that are made by immense and tedious effort at various locations around the world. The reason for the cessation of these activities is simple. Why, say the archaeologists and anthropologists, continue to speculate based on scanty evidence when the whole story is rapidly unfolding under the microscopes of genetic scientists? In other words, why guess, only to possibly be proven wrong in the very near future? Quoting from a most recent issue of National Geographic in an article entitled The Greatest Journey by James Shreve, in the past 20 years, genetic scientists have found a record of ancient human migrations in the DNA of living people. Every drop of human blood contains a history book written in the language of our genes. Here I should add parenthetically that unfortunately the knowledge being gained has the potential for enormous abuse. For example, insurance companies and employers can learn much unwarranted information about potential health risks and other possible problems of prospective clients and potential employees, respectively. But the story I'm telling today is about the good news coming out of this research. How does it all work? Again, quoting from the National Geographic article, the human genome is 99.9% identical throughout the world. What's left is the DNA responsible for our individual difference, as well as some that serve no apparent purpose at all. Once in an evolutionary blue moon, a random harmless mutation can occur in one of these functionless stretches, which is then passed down to all of that person's descendants. Generations later, finding the same mutation or marker in two people's DNA indicates that they shared the same ancestor. By comparing markers in many different populations, scientists can trace their ancestral connections. In most of the genome, these minute changes are obscured by the genetic reshuffling that takes place each time a mother and father's DNA combine to make a child. Luckily, a couple of regions preserve the telltale variations. One called mitochondrial DNA is passed down intact from mother to child. Similarly, most of the Y chromosome, which determines maleness, travels intact from father to son. By comparing the mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosomes, in the case of males, of people from various populations, geneticists can get a rough idea of where and when these groups parted ways in the great migrations around the planet. Two great controversies that vexed anthropologists for much of the 20th century now have been solved to near certainty. One group of anthropologists in the past argued for a two-stage theory of human evolution in which a species of proto-humans migrated out of Africa to Australia over then existing land masses and evolved into Homo sapiens separately from the main group that similarly evolved back in Africa. Another question is whether Homo sapiens overwhelmed European Neanderthals in the struggle over limited resources, whether the Homo sapiens absorbed the depleted Neanderthal population through interbreeding. Turning once again to the National Geographic article, it is reported that scientists now calculate that all living humans are related to a single woman who lived 150,000 years ago in Africa, putting an end to the two-stage theory of evolution. Evidence from Neanderthals' DNA reveals that the two groups interbred rarely, if at all. Neither mitochondrial DNA from the Neanderthal fossils nor human DNA bears any trace of the ancient mingling of bloodlines. DNA studies have confirmed over and over that all variously shaped and shaded people of the earth trace their ancestry to African hunter-gatherers some 150,000 years ago. The diversity of genetic markers is greatest in Africa, and remember that entire scope of the human genetics diversity is 0.1%, meaning that modern humans lived together in Africa for a much longer time than has elapsed since the first human migrations out of Africa, roughly between 50 to 70,000 years ago, a time period not sufficiently long enough for the rest of humanity to match the genetic diversity of modern-day Africans. Studies are also being done on such more recent human migrations, such as those of the Indo-European tribes out of the Caucasus and into the Mediterranean basin. Another study is on the origins of the Basque, whose language seemed to bear no traces or influences from the peoples around them. These recent studies in genetic markers have a special and personal interest for me. My father was left as a foundling on the doorstep of a Catholic orphanage in Calgary, Alberta. Over the course of his life, he had two families with children roughly 25 years apart in age. In his original family, which includes me, he claimed his parents were two Scottish immigrants who abandoned him in Calgary on their way west. His second family tells me he often said his mother was a Scottish immigrant who had a child by a blood Indian in the Alberta area. This story ends the same with his abandonment to a Catholic orphanage. Which is true? I've recently learned that for $100 and a swab of my saliva sent to a lab in California, I can receive a definitive answer. But getting back to the main story, perhaps, the National Geographic article concludes, the most wonderful of the stories hidden in our genes that, when unraveled, the tangled knot of genetic diversity today leads us all back to a recent yesterday, together in Africa. That concludes the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is our engineer. Again, you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Stay tuned now for the food show.
Announcement from the Old Moles today. There's a war tax resistance and redirection workshop going to be held tonight at 7 p.m. That's Monday, the 20th. That's tonight at 7 p.m. at Laughing Horse Books at 3652 Southeast Division, hosted by the War Resisters League, the Portland chapter. Opposed to war? Then why help pay for it? More information, 503-238-0605.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor An Evening in Vietnam, a benefit for Village School Foundation. Experience Vietnamese culture through music and dance featuring nationally known guitarist and storyteller Dun. Enjoy Vietnamese food and a special video presentation of the Village School Foundation's recent efforts to provide education resources to the children of Vietnam. The event will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, February 25th at the PCC Rock Creek Campus, Building Number 3. For more information, please call 503-957-0740 or 503-997-2260.